It's not your first book, is it?
Yes.
Well, congratulations.
I never had time to write one before. I had to wait till my children were grown.
It's a wonderful, wonderful book.
Thank you.
How old are your children?
Oh, they're very grown. One is 32 and the other one is 30, but it took me years to write the book.
How lucky for you to have grown children.
Yeah, I am.
Because you had, you wrote a column for the Times for a long time.
2 years, yes. Yeah. Yes, and I write editorials. That's my regular job. You know, that's my normal work. I'm on the editorial board.
Mm-hmm.
So I haven't, and I'm not a very fast writer. So given all that, it took me a while.
How does one get onto the editorial board of the New York Times?
Well, I don't know that you try to get on it. They seem to find you. That's how I got on it. I wrote the, when the Hearst column had just, was only running about 1 or 2 years, and it was very, very prominent, you know, when it first started, because there hadn't been anything like it at the Times. I think it was around 79, I think it started, or 78. I wrote eight of the columns purely by chance, and I hadn't done anything like that before. So after I did those columns, I was then working on a fashion magazine. They wanted to hire me, but in what capacity they really couldn't imagine. I mean, because I had never worked on a newspaper. But then I met Max Frankel, who was head of the board at the time, and Max decided that he would, he was looking for a writer, so he hired me. So that's how I ended up on the board.
So you came from, what fashion magazine was it?
Mademoiselle.
So you came to the Times from Mademoiselle.
Yeah.
But during the time that you were...
Kind of an odd leap, but worked out. It was.
It's journalism.
Yeah.
But while you were at the magazine, you did write those columns.
Yes, I was still at the magazine when I was writing the columns. Yeah.
So you write the editorials or something?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Because nobody knows exactly who writes them.
That's right.
So theoretically, anybody could trade off, I guess. Huh? Once you have regular board meetings to determine what
three mornings a week we meet. Oh no, we couldn't trade off because some people are conversant in one subject or 12 subjects, and some people are conversant in 3 subjects. And for instance, I couldn't. We have some people there who write foreign affairs. They've been students of foreign affairs for many years. I couldn't write those, you know. On the other hand, I write a lot about domestic policy, and I kind of follow that. And the people who write the foreign affairs stuff wouldn't be following the domestic policy stuff the way I do. So we can't trade off. We really don't, for the
most
part.
So you have three meetings a week.
Yeah.
And to determine what subjects you're going to tackle, or what approach, or both?
The subjects, really. The approach doesn't necessarily represent a consensus. It's the person whose area the subject falls into will have an opinion on that subject. If he or she can muster a good argument, you know, and defend the position, well, then that becomes the editorial. But that does not mean that we all agree with that person's opinion. It's that that person has defended it very successfully, and that is the one that the head of the board will go with as the Times position.
But the fact that it appears as an unsigned editorial does represent the paper's position.
Oh, yes, it does. That person's position becomes the paper's position, yes.
Now, the editorial board and the people who work for the editorial page are autonomous, I would assume, within the Times organization.
The editorial board? Well, the editorial board reports directly to Jack Rosenthal as head of the board, and then, of course, to the publisher. We're separate, entirely separate from the news operation, which reports to Max Frankel. So in that sense, we're autonomous. Yeah, we're separate.
Are you also responsible for the op-ed page?
Jack is. Jack Rosenthal is. Well, there's an op-ed editor, but I think Jack, I'm not too sure of this, but I think Jack supervises both. But there is a separate op-ed page editor.
Are you part of what I hear on some of these radio talk shows, the liberal left news media? Is this what they call it, the liberal left? Are you part of that, whatever that is or whatever that means?
Oh, I've never heard the Times define itself in quite those rigid terms.
You don't listen to WABC radio?
No, no, I don't.
All these people, it's very, very conservative.
Yeah,
station.
Yeah.
I hear all these people calling and blast
no,
liberal left news media.
I never hear it, yeah.
How can you avoid it?
Easy.
Everywhere I go, I hear complaints. You know, I'm part of the liberal left news media establishment.
Yeah, yeah.
It used to be, people used to say, do you get your orders from the Kremlin?
Oh.
You're from Bristol, Rhode Island. No, I'm from Wichita, Kansas.
You know,
from an oil family.
Yeah.
You know, and to be labeled so broadly as part of liberal left news media to say would be such irresponsible.
Yeah, yeah.
What happens when you go out in public? Do people tackle you and say, Mary, these editorials are just awful or disgraceful? How do you take that position?
I think I lead a quiet life. And if I'm with a group of people that I don't know very well, say at a cocktail party, you know, that kind of thing that I might not normally go to, but if I'm at a cocktail party, I tend not to make any point about where I work or what I do, because I'm there only because I'm a friend of the host or the hostess, and I'm going to spend 15 minutes, you know, having a drink and circulating, and I'm not there for a debate or anything like that. I prefer to keep my debates within the office.
But how can you cloak yourself in anonymity like that?
Oh, I'm real good at it.
but people really like to know what other people do.
If somebody asks me a direct question, of course I answer, but I don't volunteer.
So I could come up to you in a cocktail party and say, what do you do?
Oh, then I'd say, yeah.
But obviously you don't want to go into... Of course, nobody would actually know which editorials you actually wrote, would they?
No. Mm-mm.
So you can hide. You can hide under that anonymous editorial we, in a way, I guess, huh?
It's not a matter of hiding. It's a matter of, you do that work 10 hours a day, and when the day is over, I don't want to continue it until the next morning.
10 hours a day?
Well, yeah, it's a long day. Yeah.
Don't you have a union?
Well, it's because if sometimes I get out of there in 8 hours, but if we have something running the next day, mm-hmm. you know, you usually have to stay around and make sure, you know, about the editing and last-minute checks. So it tends to be longer if you have something running the next day.
Can't you kind of write generic editorials that can go anytime?
No.
No?
No.
So you peg all your editorials on the...
On the day's news, yeah.
What kind of position are you developing, or not you, but is the Times developing a position on the campaign? Will it develop a position on the campaign?
Well, I'm sure it will endorse. Mm-hmm. It always has. At least in the times I've been there, yes, it's always endorsed.
Now, how does that come about? You mentioned that people who have a certain expertise in certain areas write the editorials, but will the board itself meet and have... How many members are there on the board?
About 12.
Do you vote? Say you want to endorse Clinton. Would you have a vote on this or what?
No, we'd have considerable discussion.
And then who makes the final decision?
The publisher. Who is not there, but he would make the final decision, I'm sure.
So you reach a consensus, and you want to go for Clinton, but the publisher says, no, I like Bush. Then what happens?
I don't know. That's never happened since I've been there.
Yeah. How long have you been with the Times?
11 years.
That's quite are you part of the Newspaper Guild? The editorial board? Are they Newspaper Guild members?
Yeah.
What's it like working at the Times? Is it like a family, a home, or what? Or just a place to work?
I think it would be terribly hard for somebody who writes editorials to answer that question, because we work in a certain degree of isolation, rather differently from the rest of the Times people. For instance, I'm not sitting in a newsroom. We each have our own office, and we are alone most of the day, except for our meetings, and of course people come in to see us and all that kind of thing. And because we are alone, I think I don't think we developed a camaraderie that you might in another place. We are isolated. And I'm very friendly with all the people there, but that I work with. But there's no particular camaraderie because we are communicating electronically to our editors. You know, we're just sitting there in front of our terminals all day long, writing back and forth and to each other, checking the wires and talking on the phone. You know, to our sources and contacts. So in that sense, rather an odd job, and so I can't compare it. So I don't know what it's like for other people who work on the Times.
Gosh, I wonder what it would be like having a private office. Oh, I work at a terminal out in the newsroom, and when I get up, I go to the bathroom or something, come back, and usually somebody sitting at my terminal.
Yeah.
Sometimes they sign it off. I lose my stuff.
Yeah.
You know, and I just wonder what it would be like being a newsroom, but having a private place.
No, I like it.
I had a guy I went to college with, Gene Meroff, used to be an education writer for the Times several years ago, and he hated it simply because of the lack of privacy, no place to file things. And, he had the same problem. You know, he'd come in, there'd be somebody sitting at his desk, and so he quit now. He's working for some institute or on education policies and has written a number of books on educational issues.
Yeah.
But he was uncomfortable at the time simply because, well, the lack of privacy, and I think what bothered him most of all was the lack of file space to keep his notes and books and things. And we have that here, too.
Yeah.
No room. Mm-hmm. In fact, two summers ago, I came back to discover that someone had gotten the security people to unlock my file cabinet and emptied my file cabinet. They wanted the space.
Oh.
I was furious.
You should be.
Yes. There's always a lack of space, and I guess I'm a rat packer anyway. But we're here to talk about your book, American Girl, Scenes from a Small Town Childhood. It takes a certain degree of ego, I think that people would be interested in somebody's childhood. But by the same token, it takes the ability to write it and to make it interesting. This is something that you've done. I don't know how you remembered all of these details. I look back at my childhood, and it's all foggy and hazy. How is it that your childhood is so vivid to you?
Well, first, I want to say something about ego. I didn't have enough ego, I feel, for that book. Because, first place, it wasn't my idea. An editor suggested that I write it. About my childhood, because she said my childhood was so often in the background of my articles. And all the time that I was writing it, I was just, and I think the reason it took as long as it did was considerable self-doubt. Because I kept wondering who would want to read about a childhood that was essentially, if not necessarily happy, comparatively serene. You know, I don't have some, you know, and then I've always been, but then I kind of changed my mind and thought, I've always read memoirs and letters and biographies and autobiographies. And then I thought, all right, it was a peaceful childhood, but it was an American childhood. And I think it's as valid a contribution to the literature of American childhood as any other. Maybe not in terms of merit, I don't mean that. But the kind of life I led was led by a lot of people growing up in this country, and I thought, well, why not write about this, this?
It was not unlike the childhood I had.
Yeah.
It was a comfortable middle-class childhood, although I'm from the Midwest.
Yeah. I think sometimes you always feel, sometimes you feel that you have to write about something really sensational. And, of course, the whole thing, it's all on how you say it. It's all on how you tell it. You know, the most sensational story in the world can be gray in the wrong hands. So I felt a little better eventually.
Yeah, you don't have to necessarily have incest, rape, and murder in your childhood to make life interesting.
No, but there were moments when I kind of wished for it.
I could spice this up.
To spice it up, yes. But
it's also a historical record.
Well, that's another thing. That's what I thought.
Because here's a period, you're talking about the 30s and the
40s, yeah.
That it's easy to forget about. and here's you are telling about the way things were at that time.
Yeah.
There are people who believe that life did not begin before 1960 or 65 or 70 even, and anything before that didn't exist, or it's just a figment of our imaginations, but it did exist, and there were people, and they did lead lives the way you describe in many respects, and that's important to hang on to that in ways that go beyond photographs, if that makes sense.
Oh, yeah, I love reading personal accounts and about almost anything. I've always loved reading them. And I love hearing my friends talk. I mean, when somebody goes to, say, Europe, I'm one of the few people I know that will sit through, you know, the recitation, and I'll say, okay, you got on the plane, and then what happened? Because I really love to know, you know. So I guess that's why I really love to write that stuff.
I'm like that with photographs that people take on vacations, or family photographs, snapshots and things. I love looking at those. Most people, when they hear their friends are coming back from Switzerland, they don't want to sit there and watch their slides.
Yeah.
I do too.
Yeah.
I guess in a way, reading your American Girl almost makes me a voyeur, doesn't it?
I don't know what it is, but
it's
something I've always done.
I was, in a way, many memoirs will include in the middle of the book a whole bunch of photographs, and you didn't do that. And I was happy, in a way, because as you described your father and your mother and your sister and the various people that you grew up with, and all the people who influenced you in many ways, I began to picture them mentally.
Glad.
I think to have seen the photographs would have disrupted that mental image that you gave me in the book.
Oh.
If that makes sense. Otherwise,
yes, I'm glad to hear that. That's one of the reasons I've always loved reading, because I could never understand. I love movies and television too, but I could never understand why people preferred them. Because when I read a book, the pictures I see in my mind, are so much more vivid than any I ever see on a screen. So I'm glad to hear that.
Well, I think you came from a period where we read a lot. Now, my childhood, I didn't grow up with a television set, had radio, of course, and a phonograph, but we'd go see the movies on Saturday morning. But I grew up with books.
Well, our lives, when we were children, my friends and mine, my father certainly, and my sisters, more or less were centered on the library. I mean, that was the great forum there. Was to be going in and out of the Rogers Free Library. You know, every reader in town, that's what we did, was go to the library. It was the big trip.
Maybe you could sketch a few of the stories of your childhood that you have included in the book for me.
In what sense?
Give me some highlights of your childhood and what it was like growing up in Bristol. Come on, Mary, you've written a whole book about it.
I know. That's why, having written a whole book about it, I'm not sure. Well, I think...
Well, the water played an important part.
Well, we lived right... Yes, well, you see, water. I was there last week with one of my children, and all I could talk about was the way it smelled. It's all I ever think about. I think that's the thing, the smell, the scent of Bristol is the thing that's strongest in my own mind. It smells, and still does, of salt water and privet, and at this time of year, of linden trees. They're blooming right now. And all these smells, at least along the waterfront where I live, are melded together, and I don't know of a place in the world that smells like Bristol. I'm sure there is one, but I don't know of one. And I kept going out on my mother's porch and sniffing because of that smell. I wish I could bottle it. The water was terribly important. The weather was very important. It seems to me we had an awful lot of weather. We were always looking at the sky, you know, to see what because that's what we went by. You know, Red Sun in the morning, Sailor Take Morning, that kind of thing. We were always looking for white caps because that meant a squall. I remember tremendous snowstorms, but I think maybe everybody remembers tremendous snowstorms as a child. I think maybe it's because we were all so short that the snow always seemed so high. I don't know. But I remember the harbor freezing. I have a very clear memory of that's rare for salt water to freeze in the, and walking out on the harbor. That I definitely remember. I suppose that's one of the things I remember about Bristol.
In the house, too, because
and the house,
beginning of the book, you described the
House, that ugly house, yes. That house was like a fortress. I used to feel so sorry for my friends because I didn't know anyone besides myself who lived in the same house with not only their parents and sister, but their grandmother, their grandfather, and their aunt, as I did. And I thought that was a wonderful way to grow up. And I really felt sorry for friends who were just going home to their parents at night. I was going home to a whole zoo, you know. I really was, an ark. There was never a day, a minute in that house when I was little when I didn't have a lap to sit on. And if my grandfather was angry with me, my grandmother wasn't. Or if I wasn't speaking to my mother, I was still speaking to my aunt. You know, I was never alone, you know, in that house. I always had an ally. I always had a lap. I always had an ear. And my sister and I were the only two grandchildren, and we were adored. There's no other word for it. I don't think we were spoiled. In fact, we were raised rather strictly. But I don't think we ever doubted that we were adored.
You did have to put up with a certain degree of childhood brutality in grade school, though.
Oh, nobody could stand me outside the house. The house was my refuge. Outside the house was hell.
Why?
I think it was a curious combination of sociology and my own personality. I don't think I was entirely responsible for it. I'm sure I wasn't. It's hard to explain. You know, you almost have to live in a Bristol to understand it, but I think there are a lot of Bristols in this world. I lived down on Hope Street, which was, you know, the nice part of town and the nicest part of town, or one of them. And I had gone to a little private school. And my father believed very strongly in public schools and, in fact, was on the school committee. And when Diana and I were older, he put us up in public school where I didn't know any of the children, or very few, and they had all come from a entirely different part of town. As small as the town was, they were strangers to me. And I talked. My speech was different. My clothes were different. I think I was arrogant, although I think that was as much innocence as anything else. And I think any group needs a scapegoat. And for much of my first few years in grade school, I guess I and a few others were the scapegoats. There was another thing. I didn't understand public school mores. I didn't understand, at least in that public school, when the teacher asked a question, my hand was waving in the air. I was the first one with a hand up because that was what I'd done in private school. I didn't realize that that wasn't cool to do in public school. You know, it was considered showing off. And it was only eagerness, you know, eagerness to answer. I was a tremendously eager kid. And I had all these teeth. And, oh, and more braces and rubber bands than you've ever seen in your entire life. And I chattered all the time. I talked a lot out of sheer life, just, you know. So I kind of stood out, you know. I didn't mean to, but I was not liked. And the kids, you know, kids can be extremely brutal. I saw it happening sometimes to my own children when they were growing up, you know, for different reasons. I assume my children were brutal to other children sometimes. Certainly other children were brutal to them. Sometimes I remember now, you hurt. I think sometimes the brutality visited on a child by his or her peers is as fierce a brutality as that child will ever know in her whole life. Which is not to say that I didn't visit brutality on others. I probably did.
I agree with you. We have to be educated to be civilized.
Mm.
And when my kid was growing up, I could see he was a playground bully. We had to punish my son for attacking other children and harassing other kids. So when they talk about a playground being a jungle, I mean, it really was a jungle. And we really have to learn to be civilized, and we have to set rules and regulations. And some of these rules that we set for ourselves as adults don't seem to apply to children. So there's a lot more anarchy in a playground setting, and it needs more control by parents.
Yeah.
We talk about the innocence of childhood, but I'm not so sure children are innocent. In many ways, they seem to be desperate and selfish and greedy and brutal.
They're little animals, I think.
Yeah. So you learn.
Yeah.
You learn to be good.
Yeah.
Or some of us learn to be good.
Yeah.
And doesn't always take. Some of us have relapses as well.
Yeah.
But, I would much prefer to associate with adults than children. Simply because adult, you learn how to talk to people and behave and to be gentle and to be polite, even if you don't want to feel that way. I mean, this is not always the case. I mean, we live in New York is a very dangerous and violent city, and more than, say, the Midwest, you see brutal incidents on the street, cab drivers fighting, and There's a sense of desperation. The city's so congested, so noisy, and there's always this feeling of anxiety wherever you go in New York. And sometimes it spills over, and we become like children again, fighting over parking spaces. I was getting off the subway the other day, and this huge woman was pushing on as I was trying to get off. And for me to get off, I had to push against her to get out of the door. And she begins to scream at me and curse me, all this profanity, and then she hits me in the side just as the door closes. And I was shocked.
Mm.
I think I stepped on her foot trying to get around her, because as soon as the door opened, she began to come in before we could get out. And I thought, whoa, what uncivilized behavior. Children might do something like that. But how in a grown woman could do something like that? It's beyond me. It's as though she had reverted to this primitive element in herself. Well, it wasn't always that way. As you went into high school, you became popular. In fact, on the cover of your
book, I don't think I ever became popular.
Well, there's a picture. You had a boyfriend.
But I became. Oh, I always had a boyfriend. I was very pretty when I got older. The braces came off my teeth and. So I think for most of the time I was in high school, I was really rather pretty. So I might have been popular with a few boys, but I was certainly not, universally popular. But at least I was bearable, And I was, and by that time I had begun to have courses that interested me a little bit. So I was quite happy in high school.
Well, you take your story up through high school, and it ends there. Are you going to pick up the story at any event?
Yes. Yeah, I think so. I got kind of interested in the narrator of this book. I forgot that the narrator was me, kind of distant from her, and I thought, well, I'd like to. I had never planned to continue it, but when I finished the book, I thought, well, I'd like to hear her voice again, older. This time and continue, but not pick up the story, so to speak, if there is one, about 5 years later.
You could have made a fiction out of this. I mean, a lot of people explore their childhood and their relationships as young people and relationships with their parents in a fictional way.
I always wonder why. Well, I wonder sometimes if that isn't a form of hiding.
Well, I guess
I don't know. I was never tempted to turn it into fiction because, in a way, I thought that would have been cheating. I feel if I have something to say about my relatives, I really ought to come out and say it, you know. But the other thing is I love a certain kind of journalism. And I've always read considerably more nonfiction than I ever did fiction, and I think that one of the reasons I want to, first place, I don't even know if I could write fiction, but I've always been interested in nonfiction and in a certain kind of journalism. It's my favorite kind of writing to read. So it's natural for me to have done it in that way. I think you have to be more reserved if you're writing nonfiction to a degree. And since there are very severe limits on what I want to say about myself, I have to be a little more guarded than I might be if I were writing fiction. But in a way that makes doing it as nonfiction even more challenging. I rather like those restrictions.
Well, I was talking to William Manchester a few years ago. He'd written a memoir about his days in the military in World War II in the Pacific Theater. And I was asking him about certain scenes in the book, and he seemed to have no memory of them. And I asked him about a character who played a big role, and he said, no, there's no character. And I opened up the book. And I came to a passage and cited his name. He said, oh, that's right. He said, I changed all the names of everybody in the book. And some of them are composites of various people that I put in. And some of the scenes are a little exaggerated. So while this was a nonfiction book, actually he played a little loosely with the truth, simply to make the book apparently more dramatic. Something you're not guilty of course.
No, I'm not. Although several times I just gave people's initials or changed their names, first names, because I didn't want them to be hurt, or maybe in several cases I was only one of three people who knew this story or something like that. And although I was... It's funny, I thought I was so careful. And I was in Rhode Island a couple of weeks ago, and I was talking to the man who runs the local newspaper. He was a walking Rosetta Stone. He recognized every single person in the book, even the ones, you know, that I'd, you know, hidden the name of or something. He knew every single one. And I think that's... So
Did you go back to Bristol for a book signing or anything?
Yeah, it was fun.
What was it like?
It was amazing. It was, in the first place, it was an awful lot of people, which was thrilling for me. In the second place, there was, I think, a representative from, or more, from every single economic and ethnic strata in Bristol. See, one of the things that was so interesting about Bristol to me, and why it is endlessly fascinating to me, is that it's bigger now. Now it's about 20,000 people, but when I was growing up, it was only 10 or 11,000. And it had as varied a population as you could have in New York City. It really did. Extraordinary. Except that there were only two blacks and no Asians. That was absolutely everything else. And every religious group, everything was amazing. And so, and that was why it was so interesting. I mean, you had all these different pockets of different cultures all over this tiny town. And at this signing, there was kind of somebody from every group, including one woman I didn't know her, but she came up, and I didn't know her name, so when I was filling out the thing, I asked for her, I asked the name, and she told me, and I gasped. Because she was the one whose mother I had described as secretary of the DAR and local numbers runner. And I kind of gasped, and the woman laughed and said, you made my family notorious. But she laughed, you know, because it was true, and she found it funny. She also remembered my grandmother as one of her mother's hot customers for the numbers. And Then there's somebody in the book that I call that I quote the Bristol same Bristol Phoenix Master Bobby Kinder, who used to who was at birthday party and he gave the little guests, we were all 6 years old at the time, a colonial bouquet. Well, Master Bobby Kinder is now an ophthalmologist. In fact, he's my mother and aunt's ophthalmologist, lives in Providence, and he showed up carrying a colonial bouquet.
Aww.
So it was really quite wonderful, and in it I had mentioned seeing a little thing about running into the post office and seeing Mr. Bosworth, who was then editor of the Bristol Phoenix, the little newspaper. And Mr. Bosworth is well into his 90s now, but he was at the, you know, he came with a book to be signed. And needless to say, I called him Mr. Bosworth. I'd never call him by his first name. I said, for Mr. Bosworth. So it was really quite exciting and wonderful.
So you do go back frequently. Your mother is still lives there.
And my mother and aunt, yes. And my uncle died only recently, yeah.
So you get back on a regular basis.
Yes.
It's almost like not being away then. It's not like Wichita. I haven't been to Wichita since I was 2 years old, and I just have vague, almost sinister memories of Wichita. I mean, really vague. 2 years old, you can't remember that much. So it'd be very interesting to go back and see it. But since you have a family in Bristol, it's not like...
I don't go back terribly often, simply because Bristol's very hard to get to. It's easy enough if you drive.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're relying on public transportation, my daughter and I went there, well, it was last week, and it took us about 7 hours to finally get to my house.
Well, how did you get there?
Well, you have to take a train from Grand Central, and that train from Penn Station, and the train is always late. Then they've moved the railroad station, so you have to walk down through this hill through a construction site, lugging your luggage down to where the bus stop is. And and because the train was late, as it always is, we missed the bus, so we had to wait an hour for the other bus, and then we had to wait for that. But I mean, it just takes a long time between trains, missing buses, hikes.
Well, why didn't you fly to Providence?
Because I did that 3 months ago, rather, and it was incredibly expensive trip. The airport is way on the other side of Providence, so you have to have somebody meet you and then drive. I mean, there's just no way you can get there. It's just a difficult place to get to. It's down on a little peninsula, mm-hmm. out on the water.
But you should be able to drive there from...
Driving's there...
4 hours?
Yeah.
Three and a half hours, perhaps?
4 hours. You can drive it. But unless you're driving, it's one of those places like, you know, obscure parts of Maine. It's just hard to get there.
Where did you go on to college after Bristol?
Connecticut College.
And what did you study there?
English.
And your intention was to be a journalist?
No.
Author or what?
No. My intention was to read a lot. I didn't have an intention. I thought if I was going to do anything, I thought after college I would go to graduate school. I was planning to go to Yale. And then eventually I wanted to get, you know, graduate degrees and eventually teach college, in a college. My father died when I was a sophomore, and that kind of took away a lot of my impetus for anything. So I never did go to graduate school. I just graduated and went to New York because the boy I was going out with was in New York, and I'd never been in New York, and a friend and I thought it'd be fun to live in New York. We'd seen movies. I'd only ever come down here for the theater. We used to stay on the college floor at the Biltmore Hotel. So all I really knew of New York was the Biltmore Hotel and the theater district. And I came down to New York and I got married. And I don't think I've ever planned anything. I just kind of, I envy those who do. I kind of fall in and out of things. And whatever I do, I tend to work hard at, but I cannot say I ever had a game plan or any particular goal. I think I wanted more than anything to be a writer, but I was so in awe of writing and writers that I don't think I... never even articulated it, even to myself.
Well, I'm in awe of writers who get their work published. I know a lot of writers who don't. Well, you whetted our appetite for a continuation of American Girl, because at the beginning you talk about, in fact, you allude to a failed marriage, and it'd be kind of interesting to see what happens next to the young woman in this memoir.
Well, the next book is going to be about New York, and I hope I can bring to it the same sense of place and the same affection, really, that I brought to Bristol.
No reason why you can't. American Girl, it's a beautiful book by Mary Cantwell. Thank you very much.